always going to do what is right. That's what I've always done in my courtroom. And I've always slept really, really well at night.
Karofsky's swearing-in came on the same day Governor Tony Evers' statewide mask mandate went into effect. Any legal challenge to the mandate would go before the court. The state's highest court is also expected to rule in the coming months on a case that could purge up to 129,000 voters from Wisconsin voter rolls. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sports, baseball, the White Sox over the Royals 9-2. The Cubs beat the Pirates 2-1, checking the schedule. The White Sox and Brewers begin a series tonight at 7:10. The Royals and Cubs go at it at 7:15. In the NBA, Houston beat Milwaukee 120-116. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. It includes that beach hazards warning for high waves and dangerous currents through tomorrow night. Cloudy skies today, a high around 70. North winds gusting as high as 30. Cloudy tonight, a low around 58. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, a high of 70. Expanded forecast Wednesday through Friday, a warmer period. By Friday, we'll be up around 81. Just a slight chance of rain Thursday evening. Right now, 61. I'm David Cole, WGTD News.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am really delighted to be connecting with Dr. Gary Wood, who for many years was a member of the chemistry faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. As far as I know, maybe in some respect he still is, but his primary responsibility now, and it has been since 2013, is serving Parkside as Vice Provost for Academic Affairs. And Dr. Wood's name came up during my recent conversation with the Chancellor and the Provost of UW-Parkside in terms of talking about what finishing the spring was like, what the summer and anticipating the fall has been like under the shadow of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Wood's name came up more than once when it came to the matter of how to sort out the fall and where to put everybody. And that just sounded really intriguing. I mean, one of those huge challenges, a puzzle, as I think the provost characterized it, Robert Dukoff. And so we're going to be talking, in effect, to the puzzle master or one of the puzzle masters contending with this challenge. And, of course, it's not anything unique to Parkside. It's a challenge being faced by Gateway and Carthage and colleges and universities all across the country and, indeed, all around the world. And not just at, of course, the level of higher education, but education in general has become much more complicated than it once was, not that it wasn't plenty complicated to begin with. So anyway, we're going to kind of explore a bit of this with Gary Wood, and I appreciate him making time in a very busy schedule to join me. Dr. Gary Wood, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me. And yes, it is a puzzle, and we're working on it currently, so I hope I can lend some insight into how that process is going.
I'm really looking forward to that. Can you say a quick word about what the responsibilities of the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, what those responsibilities are?
My responsibilities are wide and varied. I work with the deans, I work with the department chairs, I work to support the provost. We work primarily on student success initiatives, anything having to do with what people would identify as a typical academic program at a university, the English department, the chemistry department. That's what we're involved with. What I say, I give this presentation at orientation sessions that parents attend. If the provost's office is doing its job, nobody knows that there's a provost's office. We work in the background to support the work of the deans and the faculty and the academic departments.
Right. So if you're doing your work well, then everybody else sort of at the forefront gets to do their work well.
Right.
That's part of it anyway. When you were presented with this opportunity, I mean, maybe this is too personal a question, but back in 2013, did this opportunity become available and did you go after it or did they go after you or was it a little bit of both? And I'm also curious about what it felt like to shift from the classroom where you had focused your energies for such a long time into this slightly different though related arena.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. I was a member of the chemistry department for 26 years and had been teaching for that long. And as you said, I mean, I retain my formal affiliation with them, although I'm not teaching classes anymore. The opportunity presented itself. Other opportunities, well, during my 26 years as a chemistry faculty member, I had sort of drifted into administrative work as faculty sometimes do. I was a department chair. I was the director of a couple of different programs. I had a position called secretary of the faculty, which is sort of a behind the scenes position that helps some of the governance groups run. So I had taken on some of that work. And so over the years, I had drifted that way. And a couple of other opportunities had presented themselves. I just didn't feel like it was the right time or they were the right opportunities. I wasn't really looking for something else to do, but then this opportunity came up, the time felt right. And I thought, and I wasn't at all tired of being in the classroom or burnt out from teaching or anything like that. But I just thought 26 years is a long time to do the same thing. And here's a new opportunity and a chance for me to use all the knowledge I've built up over all that time to help serve the broader institution rather than just the one department.
Very good. So it's felt like a good fit, evidently, since you're still doing it all these years later. And it doesn't sound like you at least terribly miss all the test tubes and all the students and all the classroom stuff that you did, or do you miss it at least from time to time?
It's been a good transition, and I enjoy the work that I do. The things that I miss, it was sort of difficult to give up having a laboratory space to work in. I don't have that anymore, so I'm not doing any research anymore. And yes, I do miss being in the classroom with students on a daily basis. And that really comes home to me when I go to commencement ceremonies now, because I don't know any of the students anymore. That feels very odd to me. So I miss having that direct connection with students.
So before we talk about the fall, I would really like to talk a little bit about the spring and get your perspective on what it was like when COVID-19 began to impact all of us very directly, including all of you at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. So you obviously, as you've already made clear, were not one of the teachers who had to figure out how to teach in this new scenario. But I'm sure as vice provost, you had all kinds of things you were needing to do to try to help the faculty at Parkside respond to this. What were the biggest challenges for you specifically and personally during the early days of COVID-19?
I guess the biggest challenges were, number one, just the logistics of getting all the courses translated into the online system that we use. Our learning management system is called Canvas. I don't know what you're used to using that at Carthage, but there was just a lot of technical work to do to get all the courses, in the term they use, migrated over into the online system. We were fortunate, I think, in that we've been I wouldn't call it a shift, but we've had an initiative over the last, I don't know, at least 10, 15 years to do more online offerings. So even though faculty in this past spring may not have been teaching online classes, many of them had experience teaching online classes. And so while it was a sort of a, you know, a big lurch for them to take a face-to-face class halfway through the semester and convert it to an online class, it wasn't as if none of them had experienced teaching online before. So we've been running a summer workshop for faculty and instructional staff for 12 or so years now to train people formally to do effective online instruction. And we've trained over 100 people to do that. And so the faculty and instructional staff generally were prepared to do the online teaching. So that made it a little bit easier. That pertains to sort of what you would think of as traditional students in a classroom classes. That transition wasn't that difficult for most people, or at least most of the faculty and instructors. It's more difficult for students in some cases, I think. The real difficulties came with the classes that are really difficult to replicate in an online environment, like laboratories, like music classes. You can't very well rehearse the choir online. If students are enrolled in a ceramics class, they can't bring the pottery wheel home. If students are enrolled in a chemistry lab or an anatomy lab, they can't bring the specimens home or the lab equipment home. So that's where we struggled a bit. There are some reasonably good online resources for doing science labs in a virtual environment, for example. Those are the biggest struggles, to try to give students in those kinds of laboratory, studio, et cetera, courses a reasonably good experience to finish out the semester.
So I would love to hear a word or two about your own specific academic discipline of chemistry. And honestly, until you started talking about it, it hadn't really dawned on me just how difficult that would be to, as you say, give chemistry students signed up for a lab some kind of meaningful experience that would come even close to what it would be like to actually be physically in the lab doing what you would typically be doing. So at least as far as you know from your chemistry colleagues, how successful were they, and what were the ways by which the seemingly impossible could at least sometimes be accomplished?
Well, there are typically two main parts to a chemistry lab experience, and one is students carry out some kind of procedure using chemicals and equipment, and then make observations and collect data along the way. So that's part one. Part two is they process the data and produce a report. So it's pretty easy to replicate part two of that. You can give students data and have them work with the data and produce the data reports and learn how to do the statistical analyses and so on. It's more difficult to replicate part one, where they're carrying out the procedures and collecting the data. There are pretty good, reasonably good virtual ways to do that. There are simulations that students can work with online. It's, I guess, the best way to describe it, it's sort of like, you know, a chemistry lab is a video game. Like, pick up the test tube and add this and add that and watch what happens. So there are ways to replicate part of that. There are also a lot of good video tutorials. One of the things our department did was the lab instructors video recorded themselves carrying out the procedures to demonstrate to the students how things would look. So that's all fine. What's missing, of course, is that students don't have the actual experience of manipulating the instruments themselves and learning how to push the right buttons and weigh things and measure things and whatnot. There's no way to really replicate that. So it's not the same, but it was okay.
Mm. It reminds me of talking to a welding instructor at the Gateway Technical College. And one of the things he talked about was obviously much of what would typically happen in a welding class at Gateway could not happen, but other things could happen. And maybe those other things, which are not unimportant, more of that could happen. And then at some point along the road, when maybe life returns to normal a little more, some of that other stuff they could not experience directly, they can experience that at some point and shore up those aspects of what we're ultimately sort of missing from the experience. And I suspect some of what you're talking about is a little bit like that as well.
Sure, there are good similarities there actually. You can teach, I know nothing about welding, but you can teach, I presume, the safety procedures that have to be in place in a welding shop, for example, without having students being in a classroom. But without having the tools in their hands, they can't actually, they have to practice welding to become proficient at welding. So yes, a lot of that, the same thing applies to a lot of the, not just the science labs, but I said, to, you know, the art studio courses, the theater performance courses, the music performance courses, and so on. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Gary Wood, Dr. Gary Wood, who is Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, right up the road from us here at Gateway and WGTD. And Gary Wood has been very busy behind the scenes trying to help the faculty of Parkside to contend with all of the challenges of this COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, paramount in your attention and energies right now is helping the faculty and helping the school prepare for the fall semester and all kinds of challenges that are part of that. First of all, although we did discuss some of this with the chancellor and provost the other day, maybe you could just give us your own perspective on the difficulty of planning for a fall that isn't yet clear. I mean, early in the summer, I'm sure no hard and fast decisions have been made about what was going to happen in the fall, and yet you and others had to begin laying the groundwork for plans. How does one do that? How do you plan for an uncertain future?
Well, that's exactly right. And our goal starting, we worked back in March, April, May, really our focus was on finishing up the spring semester. And we purposely focused on that, knowing in the back of our minds, and it wasn't just in the back of our minds, of course, we acknowledged it, that as soon as the spring semester is over, we're gonna have to start working right away on what's gonna happen in the fall. But we focused on the spring, during the spring, and then as soon as that term was over, we started thinking about the fall, and our goal from day one was to offer as much face-to-face programming as we could in the fall, safely. You know, the idea being that face-to-face instruction is almost always better than virtual instruction. So let's offer face-to-face instruction to the extent that we can in a safe manner. But then, as you said, Greg, not knowing what was really going to happen in the fall, we had to be prepared at the same time to deal with, well, anything really. I mean, we had to be doing the planning for some face-to-face instruction in the fall, knowing that we might not be able to do face-to-face instruction in the fall. So that's the shape that our planning has taken to this point. We're planning on doing face-to-face instruction. We're doing the room scheduling now, as you mentioned earlier. But we realize, even though it's only 5 weeks away now, that we're not sure yet what it's going to look like. Mm.
So what came up in the Chancellor, my interview with the Chancellor and the Provost is that one of the most colossal questions and challenges in this scenario is where to put people, where to put classes, assuming that in-person learning and teaching can happen. And I think it was Provost Dukoff who said you know, he hates puzzles, you know, of any kind. And he said, but something to the effect of, unfortunately, Gary Wood is really good at puzzles and has been working really hard on this whole question. So that was the really primary reason why I wanted to talk with you, because I thought it would be very interesting to be kind of taken inside that particular kind of puzzle and to give people some appreciation for just how complicated this is. And I guess there are a couple of ways to begin, but maybe one of the best ways to begin is with kind of the whole notion of how best to keep people safe in a learning environment that's in person. And so maybe as someone who is a scientist, you can, you know, maybe kind of help us appreciate some of the challenges of just sorting out that matter of the safety and what science is telling us about how we can best keep people safe in a learning environment. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would like to say that when you called me about this interview, Greg, and told me what the chancellor and the provost had said about my role, I told them, you gave me way too much credit. It's really the, you know, our facilities management staff has been doing a great job with the actual physical layout of the classrooms. And it's the registrar's office who's doing all the room scheduling and trying to really put the puzzle together. I've been helping manage that and gathering the information that we need for those groups to work together. But I just wanted to make sure I acknowledge, you know, the people who are really doing the behind the scenes work. In terms of using classrooms safely, we're following safety protocols that have come from the CDC and from UW system, and it's the basic social distancing and face covering protocols that most people are familiar with. So what we've done, what facilities management has done, is they've mapped out, I guess is the best way to say it, all of our classroom spaces to show where we can put students to maintain the 6 feet apart distancing, including where the instructor is stationed. So that's one part of the puzzle, is just where do we put people in rooms? And it leads to some sort of surprising outcomes that people might not anticipate. Basically, if you exclude all the labs and art studios and things like that, two kinds of general purpose classrooms, the kind that have movable seating, so desks that can be moved around, and then there are classrooms that have fixed seating. So the big lecture halls, for example, fixed seating in rows. And it turns out that especially in the fixed seating rooms where you can't move seats around, the space available diminishes pretty rapidly when you start to do these calculations. So if the rows are spaced too close to each other to put students in consecutive rows, you eliminate every other row. And then within a row, if the seats are spaced too closely, so you can only put students in every third seat, well, a 220 seat lecture hall, pretty soon it's only going to hold 30 students. Wow. So that surprised us when we first started to look at it.
Surprised so. You very unpleasantly. And, yes. And I think you're right that, you know, somebody, just a civilian, let's say, you know, would walk into a large lecture hall and would immediately jump to the conclusion that, hey, we can get a good number of people into this room. And the sad fact is, because of the permanence of the layout of the seating and so on, in fact, it's not a flexible space at all. And that is a problem.
Right. Right. It's a little bit easier in the classrooms that have movable desks, because if you have 45 desks in a room, the simplest solution is to, you know, take out 30 of them and leave 15 and space them appropriately. Only even that's not so easy, because what we're discovering is, well, we don't really have space to store the extra 30 desks. So what do we do with them? And it's ugly to stack them up in the back of the classroom. It's expensive to store them off-site. It's sort of weird to keep all 45 desks in the room, but tape off 30 of them and say, don't sit here. So we're still working out some of those details for how we're going to configure those classrooms, even the ones that have movable seating. And then there's the question of cleaning. So in between classes, we're planning on providing cleaning supplies so that people can wipe down surfaces, but we don't have, and no university has, there's no staff that can sort of rush in after every single class and clean the classroom in 3 minutes and get ready for the next class to come in. So that's another thing that we're having to figure out. And then with respect to the face coverings, we did decide that we are going to require everybody, students and staff, to wear face coverings in public spaces, including classrooms. We've been exploring the use of face shields instead of face masks for instructors to use, just as a way to make it easier for people, for the instructor to talk and for students to understand what they're saying. The way that I've explained this to people in meetings is I go to the deli at Piggly Wiggly with my face mask on, and they can't understand that I'm asking for ham and potato salad. I mean, everybody does a little bit of lip reading, whether they realize it or not. And so to have the instructor's face visible while they're speaking is good for students. So we're exploring the use of some clear face shields for instructors. So that's sort of the, you know, what's happening on the, how are we going to configure the classrooms side. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, so you have not been busy with a tape measure. That's something that other people have been busy
with. So John Brook is our director of facilities management. He and his staff have been doing all of that work.
And so they were dispatched into all of these various classrooms and lecture halls, and they were charged with, in a sense, you know, making some of these calculations, or at least determining the pertinent dimensions, and then it's left to others then to take that data and figure things out.
Exactly. We create our course schedules a year or so in advance, and so way before any of this happened, we had our fall course schedule all set, or as set as it can be a year in advance. So classes were scheduled, rooms were scheduled, and course capacities were established, which, you know, range from the teens and 20s up into the 60s and 80s in some cases, and they were all put into appropriate spaces. And if we started that process from scratch every single year, it would be a big puzzle every year. But as I'm sure you know from your work at Carthage, I mean, the course schedule from one semester or from one year to the next doesn't change all that much. And so the registrar's office kind of knows, well, all the English classes can go in these rooms and all the math classes can go in these rooms. And the big chemistry lecture is going to have 80 students in it, so it needs this lecture hall. That doesn't change a lot from one year to the next, but suddenly it all has changed. So we had that all on the schedule, you know, for the upcoming fall a year ago. And now we have a report from, well, then there are two things that layer on top of that. One, we have the report from facilities management, which says, all right, this class that you thought was going to hold 80 students is only going to hold 25. The other big part of the puzzle was we had to work with the faculty and the instructional staff and the deans to figure out which of these classes that you said were going to be face-to-face in the fall, are you really going to offer face-to-face in the fall? So we reduced our face-to-face offerings pretty significantly from what they would normally be. I think in a normal year, in a normal fall semester, I'm kind of guessing about this part, but between 10 and 15%, I would say, of our classes will be offered online, and the big majority of them would be face-to-face traditional classes. For the fall semester coming up, it looks like we're going to have between 60 and 65% online, and between 35 and 40% face-to-face. So the number of face-to-face classes we have to fit into the rooms is smaller. So that helps solve the puzzle. We also worked with the deans to reduce the caps, the capacities in the classes. We also encouraged them to consider various hybrid formats. So many of our freshman composition classes, for example, meet on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And what the English department decided to do was to say, okay, we're still going to enroll 22 students in each of these composition classes, but half of them will come to class on Monday, the other half will come on Wednesday, and then they'll alternate being online those other, you know, those days. And then Friday, the whole class will be virtual, and so we only need then a classroom that can hold 11 or 12 students, not 22. So that sort of thing has helped. We've also scheduled a number of synchronous online classes. That is, you know, people think of traditional online as it's, you know, you sort of log into the class on your own time and complete the assignments and do the work and maybe participate in a discussion board here and there, but none of that is scheduled. About a fifth or so of our online classes have scheduled meeting times. So the students have to be in the class, the instructor's there in real time presenting material, all the students are there in real time and can ask questions. So not all of our online classes are just completely sort of, you know, without any interaction. So we have the sort of traditional, what we call asynchronous online, the synchronous in real time online where students have to be there at scheduled times. Traditional face-to-face where students are there in the classrooms at the regular days and times. And then the some various hybrid formats as I described for the freshman composition classes where it's part online, part face-to-face, but it reduces the overall number of students who have to be in the classroom at any one time. So those are the two big parts of the puzzle, I guess. We had to first determine which classes are going to be offered face-to-face, how many students are going to be there on each of these days. That's part one. Part two, what spaces do we have to put them in? And that's what the registrar's office is working on as we speak. I had, you know, email exchanges with them just earlier today about some of these issues. I guess I can add too, we're also looking at using spaces that we normally don't use as academic classroom spaces. So our cinema, for example, and your listeners who have attended the foreign film series will know the cinema, we can use that for classroom space. The ballroom, we're not going to be hosting many, if any, external events that would normally be in the ballroom, like wedding receptions and so on, so we can use that for classrooms. The main stage theater, although the theater department has need for that space some of the time, we can perhaps use that as classroom space. So we're looking at those spaces that we don't normally use for classes as places to put some of our larger classes.
One of the interesting things about the way Parkside is laid out, and this is something where I would say it's a little bit different from the way some of Carthage is laid out, is, for instance, we have Lentz Hall, which has, in addition to many administrative offices, a bunch of classrooms, but those classrooms are not specifically under the auspices of a particular department. And then, of course, we have other buildings like our Straz Science Center. That's natural science and some other things. But certain classrooms, in a sense, don't belong to any one particular department. It feels like when I have visited Parkside, that Parkside's beautiful facility is a little more segmented. That there's such and such hall and such and such hall and such and such hall. And I've always at least assumed that they were rather distinct or discreet in terms of the particular departments that they served. Is that in fact the case, or are a lot of the classrooms at Parkside, in a sense, sort of up for grabs under the most normal of circumstances and under these more extraordinary circumstances?
Right, so formally, all the general purpose classrooms are, as you said, up for grabs, and it's the registrar's office that does the the room scheduling. Practically, it turns out that most of the business classes, for example, are scheduled in Moreland Neuro Hall, and most of the English classes are scheduled in the Rita building. And it's just, but that's just sort of, you know, a matter of, I don't know, I won't call it tradition, but that's just how things have worked themselves out over the years. But no, aside from the specialized spaces like labs, art studios, music rooms, so on, none of the general purpose classrooms are owned by any department or college, although they tend to get used more by one department or college. But yeah, all of that's kind of up in the air right now with this rearranging we're having to do for the upcoming semester.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of the process that you described and the many decisions that, for instance, the deans are having to make, and I'm sure department chairs as well, in terms of what classes need to be in person versus what classes can be hybrid versus what classes can be essentially online across the board. It strikes me that we're talking about a scenario in which it is really important for there to be a lot of cooperation, probably more so than is typical, and both cooperation within departments and also between departments and between various schools of the college or of the university. Can you just give us a sense of some of the cooperation that is being called for right now under these circumstances when it comes to making all of these decisions, almost all of which I should think either directly or indirectly impact others?
Right, that's a good point. And we're a small enough place, so that sort of cooperation is relatively easy most of the time. As you alluded to earlier, there are some classrooms that departments sort of feel like they own sometimes, and they might have to give up some of that. And I guess, I don't know, we've been throwing around this term, this is sort of like the opposite of cooperation, and I hate to put it this way, but we've been throwing on the term lately, we need a classroom czar who's just going to make these decisions. so sort of the antithesis of cooperation, we're just having to tell people, look, sorry, I know you're used to being in this particular room, but you're just not going to be able to use it this term. We need it for something else. So with the semester, beginning of the semester sort of looming, we don't have a lot of time to have a lot of back and forth about who's going to go where. We just need to make decisions and make things fit.
What about the schedule? By and large, has the schedule remained unchanged, or have there had to be some changes made to the class schedule, either moving classes around in terms of when they meet or adding sections to classes? I mean, splitting up classes into smaller units. Have those kind of alterations been necessitated by all this?
In terms of the total number of classes being offered, no, there haven't been big changes in that respect. The biggest changes, I guess, have been, as I said, we put our schedules in a year ahead of time or so. And so the biggest change, of course, has been many, many classes that were scheduled to be face-to-face are now going to be online. So that's the biggest effect on students. Continuing students who registered last spring for what they were going to do in the fall now find themselves enrolled in a number of online classes that they thought were going to be face-to-face, but now aren't. So that's been the biggest change. But in terms of what's available, no, we haven't really had to cancel much. We haven't had to add many extra sections to account for the fact that the sections are going to be smaller. That's difficult to do this late because it requires hiring extra staff. So yeah, I mean, the biggest change has been just the shift from face-to-face offerings to hybrid and online offerings.
At Carthage, where I teach, we were, as faculty, were offered the opportunity to say that we preferred to teach in virtual environments versus in person if for any reason we have maybe particular vulnerability or other reasons for sort of heightened concern about COVID-19. And I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, that I don't really happen to be part of that population, but I think people were, faculty were asked to reach out to the school's HR department and to kind of make those arrangements in order to, so arrangements would be made where their teaching could continue to be in virtual environments. Does Parkside have something like that, or by and large, are the faculty being asked to do whatever they're going to be asked to do?
We took a very similar approach to what you just described, Greg. I think we encouraged people to offer their courses face-to-face where possible, especially when it came to courses for new freshmen. We really don't want new freshmen to be enrolled in online courses only. It's just not a good experience for them. Anybody who's done online teaching or anybody who's been enrolled in an online class, it's a different way of learning, and it's more work in a lot of ways on the students' side to make sure they're keeping up with deadlines and engaging with all of the materials. So we don't want the experience for all of our new freshman students especially to be all online. So we encouraged people to teach face-to-face to the extent that we could. Having said that, we did take the approach that you just described. If faculty and instructional staff came to us and said, look, because of my own health conditions or because of the other people in my home or whatever, we haven't forced anybody to teach in a face-to-face setting who said that they couldn't do that or felt very uncomfortable doing that. There is in cases where it needs to be a little bit more formalized, people can work through our human resources office to ask for an accommodation, in which case they'd have to, you know, provide some documentation for what the health conditions are. But up until now, it's worked out okay. Where when we ask people to do face-to-face teaching, they said, okay, we'll do that. And when people came to us and said, I really can't, we said, okay, and didn't challenge that or make them bring in a doctor's note or something.
Very good. I suppose there is a little bit of luck involved here in that a given student at Parkside might end up, luck of the draw, with all of their classes still in person. And another student might have half and half, and another student might end up with virtually everything that they're doing being online. I suspect you hope there won't be too much of that, and that for the typical Parkside student, they will have both learning experiences come the fall.
Right. I think for most students that will be the case. They'll have at least some face-to-face experience. And as I said, we focused on the freshmen. So we have a number of freshman seminar classes that will be face-to-face. We've scheduled not all, but nearly all of our 100 level math courses to be face-to-face. So freshmen coming into those courses will be in a face-to-face environment. The freshman composition classes, as I mentioned earlier, will be in a hybrid format. Well, they'll at least have some face-to-face time. A number of the other 100 level classes have a combination of online sections and face-to-face sections, right? So hopefully, and I know because we've heard from some students already that it's, you know, some are disappointed that they really didn't want to be in online classes and now they are, but that's just how it is going to be for this term. It kind of works the opposite way too. There will be students who don't want to be in face-to-face classes, and so, you know, the online options are good for them. It's going to happen also. It's inevitable that students will become ill during the course of the semester and will have to stop attending classes. And so there will need to be online options for them. So that's another thing that we're putting in place. So yeah, this is it's a new thing for everybody. I've felt like ever since the middle of March, when we had to start dealing with all of these things, we could talk to our colleagues at other institutions to see what they were doing, but no one's ever had to do this before. Mm. And so it's been interesting to try to figure it out.
Right. In a sense, nobody is an expert, or everybody is becoming an expert at the same time to varying degrees.
Exactly.
One thing that I should think is helpful is that depending on how things go with COVID-19, as well as other matters as yet uncertain in terms of development of a vaccine, for instance, but should some kind of combination solution be necessary for early 2021, the kind of work you've done for the fall semester will, I should think, serve you well for that eventuality.
Sure, I think so. I mean, now that we've done it once, we can. Are you saying if we have to do this again in the spring? Is that what you're
right? The nuts and bolts of this will not have to be done. That really only has to happen once, terms of figuring out your physical plant and what the possibilities are.
Yes, exactly. We'll have been through it once, so it would be easier to do this again for another term. We're actually doing sort of I can't call it a dry run because there are actual students involved, but we have a math summer bridge program that started this past Monday. So we do have a couple of groups of students coming to campus for the next 4 weeks. And have them in a couple of classrooms spaced appropriately with appropriate precautions. But right away we realized there were a couple of classroom issues where we realized, oh, we didn't anticipate that. and so it was really useful to really helpful. It has been really helpful it's a smaller version of what you just said. I mean, we'll have this experience from the fall to prepare us for the spring if we need to do it again. We're having the experience right now of a couple of small classes of math students that are helping us identify some things we might not have anticipated for when more students come back for the regular term in September.
It's fascinating when things go from the theoretical on paper to reality in the room, and it's possible for things to be missed. So I can see how this would be really valuable.
Yes. So I guess, if I could offer any advice to other people who are having to go through the same thing, maybe just set up a couple of pretend classes and see how things go. And it's going to make you realize the things you didn't think about.
More advice from the puzzle master at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Dr. Gary Wood, who is vice provost for academic affairs and also a member of the chemistry faculty there. Professor Wood, I really appreciate you taking the time out of, I know what is a busy, busy schedule, to talk us through all that you and your colleagues are going through at Parkside. And it serves as a nice representation of what people are going through at colleges and universities all over the globe. And I appreciate the care with which you've undertaken this challenge. And I appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Thanks so much, and best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg. It's always a pleasure. Happy to talk to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we have two author interviews, both brand new. Edward Goldberg's book is Why Globalization is Good for America. In part two, Dan P. McAdams, who teaches psychology at Northwestern University, and his book is called The Strange Case of Donald P. Trump, of Psychological Reckoning. Wednesday's Morning Show includes a conversation with Melba Beals, one of the so-called Little Rock Nine. Also a conversation with ABC's Dan Harris. On Thursday, the Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage, Dr. James Ripley. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection.
including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs.